Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. Carla and her companions have arrived safely at the Abbey, but the discovery that their enemies have gotten here first has complicated matters. Chapter 14.
My lord, the message began.
Carla stared at the blank remainder of the slip of paper before her. The only other marks on the parchment were from the ink that had fallen from her hovering quill. Each time she would force herself to begin, the words forming in her mind, but then she would freeze, ink pooling at the tip, a few drops slowly forming and falling. The words were never the right ones, but she knew that there weren't any right words, not for this, and Dawn was not far off now. She had to write something.
I thought I'd have the entire trip home to figure out what to say, she thought, leaning back from the small table in her dormitory room and reaching for the flagon of water on her nightstand. I wouldn't have to tell the Duke about Tesca until I was standing before him. But the abbot's right. There's no point delaying the news if we can get it to him faster.
After several days at sea, the silence of the dormitory was difficult to get used to. The night before, she'd camped outside, and the noises of crickets and wind in the trees had at least provided some atmosphere. But the silence here was more than the absence of anything creaking or moving about in the darkness. Allie Fane's tantrum had wound down hours ago after she'd run out of things to break in her room, though Carla had still been able to hear Allie weeping for at least another hour, even as far apart as their rooms were. Now, it seemed like the building itself was holding its breath, afraid of setting her off again. The dormitory's true silence had settled in, and Carla felt as if somehow she had become the only living creature in the world. She looked back on the evening's events and sighed. She hadn't intended to start a fight during dinner. In fact, once she'd gotten over the triple shock at seeing Allie Fane with both Benito and Jordan in her company, she had been the one to keep Grievous from confronting his former lieutenant.
"He's got just as much right to be here as we do," she had warned him as Grievous stood up from the table. "If you go after him now, like as not the monks will toss us outside with the pilgrims."
She put a hand on his arm, feeling him shake with anger. But he stayed where he was.
"I told Benito I would kill him if we ever met again," he said in a deceptively mild tone. "I would not be forsworn."
"And I don't want my own revenge on Allie. Because of her, there's still a price on my head," Carla countered, glaring at her rival as she and her two companions found a place to sit on the other side of the room, unaware of them. "Beat them to the island, Captain. That's the best revenge."
Grievous settled himself at the table, his calm demeanor once more in place, though he kept his eye turned to the part of the room where Benito and Allie were sitting. Brown-robed monks continued to enter the hall, filling the benches until Allie's group could no longer be seen.
"So," Clegg ventured, "what's all that about? I've heard of the Fane girl before, of course, though I'd not expected to see her here. And who's the other Sabrian?"
"I'd like to know that as well, mistress," Wick added. "I can't do my job if I don't know who I'm to be keeping an eye on."
"That's true," Carla sighed. "Obviously, none of us expected to find either of them here. But really, we should have."
"Why's that?" the guard asked.
"Benito was one of my lieutenants some time past," Grievous said. "He too is searching for the island, though for less noble reasons."
"Oh, right," Clegg sneered. "You just want answers to your great question. And I suppose if you get there first, you'll just leave all that gold lying around, because you're too noble to line your pockets."
"Leave it, Clegg," Carla ordered before Grievous could respond. "We don't even know if there's any treasure there at all."
She rubbed her brow, trying not to think about Jordan standing next to Allie. She looked at Grievous.
"And here we thought she'd been exiled from Kohane by her father for letting you get away. Instead, she's been out looking for Benito, and once she found him, she brought him here."
Grievous nodded. "How long have they been here?" he wondered aloud. "How much of a head start do they have on us?"
"Begging your pardon, Captain," Wick offered, "but I have to say not much, if you think about it."
All three of his companions turned to look at him.
"Well, you're here to look at the map archives, trying to find this island with only half a map. This fellow's got the other half, then?"
"Yes," Grievous admitted.
"Well, don't you see? the guard said. If they'd found it, they'd have already left. So we'd just have to figure out what parts of the archive they've already looked through. Like as not, that's a portion you won't have to look through yourself.
Carla, Grievous, and Clegg all stared at Wick, silent. Then Carla burst out laughing, leaned across the table, and kissed Wick on the forehead.
Wick, you're a genius!
Indeed, Fraterno Bellum, Grievous added, shaking his head. Why did I not think of that myself?
Most likely because the pair of you were gnashing your teeth and talking about revenge from the moment they walked in, Wick replied. Mistress, why don't I keep an eye on them while you and the captain are looking for the island? If they start packing up to go, like as not they found it, and then we just have to get the answer from them before they get away.
Well now, that's a bit ruthless, Clegg said. I'm impressed, lad. Didn't think you had it in you.
Wick shrugged. She threatened me too during the fete. Do you remember, mistress?
All too well, Carla said with a smile. It was defending Wick against Allie's threat that had earned her the guard's trust. I suppose you've got a bit of a personal stake in this as well.
Wouldn't mind seeing the Fanes taken down a peg or two, the guard admitted. There's four of us and two of them. Three, if you count the love-struck boy we met outside. Mind you, he fell apart like a sandcastle at high tide when that pilgrim broke his nose.
Wick smiled as Clegg laughed.
If there's trouble, he won't be bringing much of it.
I suppose not, Carla admitted, trying to think of a way to shift the subject away from Jordan. At that moment, the hall's outer doors were shut with a deep boom, and all conversation ended at once. A procession of four monks came out of the kitchens, and the assembly stood facing them, Carla and her companions quickly following suit. The four monks who entered were older, two men and two women. They took their places at the head table. Carla tried to determine which of the two men was the abbot, but then she saw that there were five chairs at that table, and the middle one remained empty. The woman standing to the immediate right of the center chair raised her head and addressed the hall.
"Good evening, brethren. I hope that the day's labor has been productive. Now we shall partake of the meal set before us by the Father, who invites us to grow ever closer to him by understanding the world he and his children have made for us. Praise be to the Father."
As one, the monks turned their faces to the ceiling and sang,
"Praise to the Father, who opens our eyes to see the world. Praise to the Daughter, who opens our hearts to love the world. Praise to the Son, who opens our hands to tend the world. May our eyes, hearts, and hands be forever open until the end of days."
There followed a long moment of silence, each monk lowering his or her head and making a private prayer. Then, gradually, each one sat back down as they finished, and the rumble of conversation began to rise again. At that same time, a procession of monks in aprons began to stream out of the kitchens, carrying trays bearing food and drink. These they began to distribute to their fellows, quickly heading back into the kitchen and reappearing a short time later with freshly laden trays. The meal turned out to be a single course, a large bowl of thick mutton stew, although Carla did note that there were a lot more vegetables in it than mutton. This was accompanied by baskets with slender loaves of dark bread. Most of the monks used these in lieu of a spoon, letting the stew soak into the end of the bread and taking a bite of the loaf. Several monks, she saw, kept the heel of the bread aside to sop up the last from their empty bowls. Pitchers of water and beer were set down in regular intervals along each table. Clegg received a few curious glances from the monks sitting around them when he appropriated an entire pitcher of beer for himself. Wick gave him an annoyed glare and turned to the monk sitting next to him.
"Sorry to ask, brother," he said, tapping the monk on the shoulder. He blushed as the monk turned to look at him.
"Sister, I mean."
The woman gave him a patient, amused smile.
"Could you pass over that pitcher of beer, if it's not too much trouble?"
"Certainly," she replied.
"Thanks," the guard said when she handed it to him. "Sorry for calling your brother just then. It's hard to tell from the back."
His blush deepened as the monk raised an eyebrow.
No, what I mean is, you've got all your hair cut short and your robes cover up."
He trailed off, giving Carla a helpless, pleading look as Clegg sniggered into his mug. Carla did her best not to laugh herself.
"I'm sorry, sister. We've only just arrived today."
"So I'd gathered," the monk replied, politely ignoring Wick as he buried his face in his hands.
I am Sister Miriam. Welcome to St. Ravino.
Thank you, Carlo replied. So, what is your calling? Is that the right word?
Miriam brightened.
Yes, that's right. I study architecture. My initial reason for coming here, ironically, was to study the Abbey's church.
Oh?
Yes, it's one of the few remaining examples of pre-Velasian construction in existence. Nearly all of the churches on the mainland that used it have been rebuilt or altered, following the conclave of Chambre de Brétome, of course.
Of course, Carlo replied.
The conclave's primary function was to resolve the conflict behind the so-called Velasian heresy, Miriam went on. But a secondary effect of that decision was a gradual renovation of nearly all the Velasian churches over the next 50 years to come in accord with the new doctrine.
Oh, Carlo said, having no other response to this. And you're still studying the church now?
Oh, no. My focus has expanded to include more secular buildings. I'm currently compiling a history of Malachan architecture. It's in a period of tremendous flux right now, of course.
Carla perked up, realizing she did know something about this.
I was in Trevon a year or two ago. Quite a lot of renovations and changes underway there. All the work of that architect...
She paused, trying to recall the name.
Philippe Marsan, wasn't it?
Miriam nodded.
Well, yes, but that's only the most visible sign of the flux, and Marsan's work isn't the spontaneously occurring triumph everyone, including himself, seems to think it is.
It isn't?
No, he's simply making use of an already existing trend, a regression of architectural style in the face of gunpowder's growing obsolescence, the monk replied.
The last words brought Grievous's head around from where he'd been looking toward the part of the hall Ali and Benito were seated.
Obsolescence, he asked.
Miriam looked delighted as Grievous entered the conversation.
Oh, yes, as gunpowder's unreliability continues to spread south, the information I'm compiling will be of great use to your people in the future. Do you know if the effect has extended into the Empire yet?
I do not know, Grievous replied, looking uncomfortable. I have been in the freeze for a time.
His brow furrowed as he puzzled out what Miriam had been saying.
You are talking about architectural changes brought about by gunpowder ceasing to function.
Exactly, the monk said. In the past, defense was maintained by castles and high walls. But as cannon became larger and more reliable, castles and walls became obsolete.
Her speech became even more enthusiastic as she warmed to her subject.
This affected personal combat as well, of course, such as soldiers wearing lighter armor and weapons becoming smaller. You don't need to lug a great axe around if your opponent isn't wearing plate mail. But that's not really my field of study. So, people stopped building castles and great walls. They take a great deal of time and money to build, and they're of decreasing defensive value. Then, she said, raising a finger, the elf lands appear. Magic begins to spread south. Gunpowder becomes less effective, and suddenly it's the cannon which are becoming obsolete. So...
She trailed off, looking expectantly at her audience.
So, Wick ventured, everyone starts building castles again.
Miriam beamed at him. Yes, and construction methods have significantly improved since the earlier castles were built. These new ones are larger, less drafty, and take less time to build. It's a synthesis of archaic and modern architectural styles, creating something new. And it's been going on in the northern portions of Malachi and Terrandor for years now. What Marsan did for Trevon was simply to apply those new principles on a much larger scale. It's brilliantly done, she was forced to admit. Marsan is a genius, but everyone talks as if he came up with the entire idea on his own.
She shook her head.
His work builds upon earlier innovations. I'm collecting evidence to prove it.
Clegg set down his empty pitcher and eyed the one Wick had in front of him.
So, he offered, stifling a belch, why aren't you up in Malachi, riding around looking at these new castles?
Miriam's face fell.
Funding. Carla was about to ask what she meant by that when Brother Hollam appeared, carrying his own bowl of stew.
Sorry to take so long, he said, sitting down to join them. Good evening, sister, he said with a nod to Miriam.
Brother... Miriam replied in return, still sounding downcast. I was explaining to them the problems I'm having with my work.
Hollam nodded, giving her a sympathetic look.
When is your proposal being reviewed?
2 weeks, she sighed. I'm not hopeful.
Oh, really? Who is your stubborn friend?
Brother Lazam, Miram replied, nodding as Hallam sighed.
Stubborn friend? Kerla asked.
Ah, of course, Hallam said, turning to her. When one of us wishes to present a new theory to the Abbey, or requests funding for some sort of new research, especially one that requires travel, then another monk is appointed to thoroughly examine this proposal, searching for errors and questions that the applicant may not have considered for herself. His function is to help the applicant, to hone her argument, in the manner of, as we say, a stubborn friend.
I see, Kerla replied. And Brother Lazam is known as a particularly stubborn friend?
It's not just Lazam. Brother Trober also told me he has reservations, said Sister Miram.
Lazam complains about the distance and the danger traveling that far north. There's many strange and undocumented risks that close to the Elflands, he said to me. I don't know if it's safe to send you up there until we know more. And as for Trober, he wants to go on another expedition gathering herbs, down to Brevel this time. He wants to visit the interior of the island and meet with the Galani. There's no way we can fund both of our expeditions this year.
She looked at Hallam.
Must be nice, brother, having a calling that you can follow just by climbing to the top of the observatory.
Hallam shook his head.
Oh, I don't know about that. There's more things in the sky than can be seen from here.
He looked at Grievous.
The stars are different in the Empire, aren't they?
Quite so, Grievous said with a nod. In the southern region of the Empire, the constellations are completely different.
Hallam sighed.
A longer journey than yours and Trobor's combined, I dare say. I haven't even bothered submitting a request for it.
He patted Miram's hand.
Sister, if I was debating this with Brother Lazam, I'd tell him that your work is important because it's happening now. Changes are occurring in Malachi at this moment. You have a chance to document those changes. Trobor's herbs will still be there next year.
Miram looked up at Hallam, surprised.
That's what I would tell Lazam, Hallam went on, if I was in your place.
Miram smiled. Thank you, brother. I had not considered that line of reasoning.
Always glad to help. Just don't let Trober know you got the idea from me.
Miram laughed, and with one more gracious nod to Hallam and thanks, went back to her meal.
I see you're getting along fine without me, Hallam said to Kerla, tearing off a piece of bread and soaking it in the stew.
Well enough, she replied, taking the beer pitcher in front of Wick before Clegg could grab it, filling her own mug. There was some confusion. Wick addressed Sister Miram as brother. Wick's blush returned, but Hallam chuckled, patting the guard on the shoulder. Everyone here keeps their hair cut short, Kerla said, and the women don't wear any jewelry or makeup. It's all to maintain a sense of uniformity?
We prefer to use the term community, Hallam said with a smile. We are all equals in the Father's eyes, and we demonstrate our understanding of that by dressing alike.
Kerla was puzzled. All right, so you're all equals, but there's an abbot, and Miram said there was a review of her work coming up.
Well, a place such as this needs administrators to function properly, Hallam explained. And those of us who have been here longer, those with seniority, have earned a degree of respect from the younger members. But first and foremost, we have come here in response to the Father's call, and in that sense, we are all equals.
I see, Kerla replied, taking another bite of bread after dipping it into her stew. It was warm and filling. Brother Hallam, I don't mean to rush, but I would very much like to speak to the abbot tonight, if it's at all possible.
She pointed toward the front of the hall.
The central chair at the head table is empty. Is that the abbot's chair?
Hallam nodded.
Does that mean he's not here?
Oh, he's here, Hallam told her. I went to tell him you had arrived. He said he'd come by to speak to you as soon as he could.
Kerla was about to ask why the abbot wasn't in his chair if he was in the hall, when someone wearing an apron stepped up behind her and spoke with an older, resonant voice.
Do you need another pitcher here?
Damn straight,
Clegg said with a grin.
Keep that bear coming.
You've had enough, Kerla sighed, turning to look up at the monk. We're all right here, she began, but stopped when she realized who the man had to be.
The abbot was a tall man with a medium build and a slightly stooped posture. His beard was longer than his close-cropped hair, both of them thick with white curls. His blue eyes were kindly as he squinted at her through small wire-framed spectacles.
"So, no beer," he said, nodding at the tray he was holding in his left hand. "Water, then?"
No, everything's fine, thank you," Careless said, scrambling to her feet. "It's a pleasure to meet you, sir."
"Welcome to our home," he replied, taking her hand. "I am Walter Banbrook."
He shook Grievous's hand as well when the Sabrian stood up to greet him.
"As you can see," he said, hefting the tray once more, "I'm on duty this evening, but I look forward to speaking with you in a more official capacity."
He leaned in closer.
"Brother Hollum has told me you've had a hard journey and have suffered losses."
Carla nodded.
"If you wish to get a message to Stephen, my birds are at your disposal."
"Stephen?" Carla asked. "Oh, of course, His Grace."
The abbot smiled. "One of the benefits of an old friendship is being able to remain on a first-name basis, even after we both get titles tacked on. Why don't you prepare a message for him tonight, and come see me in the morning? We'll send it to him then. It can't be very long, mind you. A few lines on a slip of paper, no more."
"Of course," Careless said.
"I'll arrange for someone to escort you to my chambers after morning service," the abbot told her. "Until then, have a good evening."
Carla and Grievous both sat back down as the abbot moved along the table, replacing pitchers at need. She watched him for a moment, smiling. Then a thought struck her. "Brother, are we expected to work in the kitchens one day in five?"
"Do you want to?" Hollum asked.
He laughed, seeing her cringe.
"No, you are our guests here. If you wish to work in the kitchens, work would be found for you, of course, but you are here for work of your own. By coming here, participating in the exchange of knowledge, you hear the Father's call in your own fashion as well."
Carla smiled, liking the sound of that. She was about to return to the remnants of her meal when she heard another voice behind her. "Carla?" Without thinking, she turned her head toward the back of the hall and saw Allie Fane standing there, her face alight with triumph. "You see," she said to Benedo and Jordan, who were next to her, "I knew it had to be her talking to the abbot." She sauntered up to Carla and Grievous, standing behind them, so they had to turn on the bench to look at her. "Caius, darling, I was so surprised to see you stand up out of the crowd and take the abbot's hand. I just had to come over to say hello." She looked Grievous up and down and put a hand on his shoulder. "I can see you've been enjoying the Duke's hospitality. You've gained some weight."
"How good of you to notice, Mistress Fane," Grievous replied without pause, patting her hand with his own. "It is a truth that a man's appetite may increase when he is no longer in fear for his life."
Allie laughed and rolled her eyes. "Oh, Caius, I don't know why you think that's changed." Then she looked at Carla. "Didn't quite recognize you with that red hair, my dear, but it's funny how everyone answers to their name, isn't it?" Her smile widened. "Ah, now that pouting glare, that I would recognize anywhere, no matter what color your hair is." She leaned in, giving Carla a friendly peck on the cheek. "Or whatever shape your ears are," she whispered. "Now, be a good girl and play along, or I'll let everyone here know what you are. Like as not, they'll just chuck a little witch like you outside to enjoy the pilgrim's hospitality." As Carla fought the urge to wrap her hands around Allie's neck and squeeze, Grievous turned his head to regard his former lieutenant.
"Benedo?"
"Captain," Benedo replied with a grin and a mocking salute, loosely tapping his right hand against his left breast.
"Are you surprised to see me?"
Benedo's free speak was not so heavily accented as Grievous's, but Carla could hear a Brevellan rhythm to his words, which told her where Benedo had first learned the language.
"Surprised? No," Grievous said. "I knew we would meet again. I have been looking forward to it. My only regret is that we cannot finish our earlier discussion at this time."
He absently rubbed at his cheek in the same location where Benedo's pink scar gleamed against his dark skin, and the smile on Benedo's face fell away.
"But there is no hurry," Grievous went on. "One day I shall pick up that debate where we left off, and bring it to a conclusion."
As monks nearby turned to regard them, sensing the growing tension, Hollum rose to his feet.
"Is there a problem here?"
he asked both Carla and Allie.
"Oh, no," Allie replied with a merry smile. "Just a group of old friends getting reacquainted. A pity we couldn't all be here for the reunion." She sighed at Grievous. "I guess you're not valued so highly as you thought, Caius. Tesca wasn't assigned to your escort."
"Actually, he was," Carla replied.
"Oh?"
Allie asked, lifting her head to glance around the hall.
"Where is he?"
"At the bottom of the ocean."
"I'm sorry?"
Allie asked, thrown off her stride. "Tesca is dead," Carla said in a clear, deliberate voice. There was a part of her that took pleasure at seeing the words sink in, seeing the shock spread across Allie's face. Then that dark thrill was instantly replaced by wrenching guilt for ever finding pleasure in saying those words. Allie's frozen moment passed, and she made a hollow laugh.
"Rubbish! You're lying!"
Then she looked into Carla's eyes.
"You are lying!"
She searched Carla's face with frantic urgency.
"Admit it! You're lying!"
Her growing anguish gave Carla pause. She'd never seen Allie like this before, her defenses down, genuinely afraid. But as she remembered how Tesca had died, her pity was washed away by a cold rage.
"It was your fault, Allie." "My fault?"
the Fane woman whispered.
"We were attacked by Sidois," Carla went on, her fury growing. "We weren't going to surrender to him, of course. We even sailed into an oncoming storm to force him to break off. But he didn't, Allie. Even with the storm nearly upon us, he came on, because he'd learned I was on board. He was after the bounty you put on my head."
Despite her shock, Allie's brow creased in confusion.
"What bounty?"
Carla's rage flared.
"Don't you dare lie to me!"
she shouted, bringing all conversation in the hall to a stop.
"Grievous and I learned there are prices on both our heads. How much did you offer for me?"
"I didn't," Allie gasped. Her denial stoked Carla's anger.
"It must be a lot to get someone like Sidois to push on in the face of a storm," Carla went on. "We had to resort to desperate measures. It didn't work. Sidois collided with us, and it was Tesca who gave us time to cut ourselves free. He went down with the Lee Rouge."
Allie's face was bone white as she desperately searched Carla's face, still seeking a lie. Her eyes were watering, her lips trembling, but still she managed to draw herself up to her full height, looking down at Carla with an imperious glare.
"I did not put a price on your head, Carla," she said, her voice cracking. "I don't pay anyone to settle my scores for me."
She drew a ragged breath.
"Tesca should have let Sidois have you."
Then she brushed past Carla and strode off, heading for the hall that led to the woman's dormitory. Carla watched her go for a moment, then glanced around her. Any monks that were not watching Allie depart were looking at her. Benito, abandoned by his patron, gave Carla and Grievous a calculating look and left as well, heading toward the men's dormitory. He glanced back at them a few times as he retreated, as if fearing Grievous would chase after him. Jordan stayed where he was, his bruised eyes wide, his mouth slightly open, watching Allie depart with a confused expression. Then he looked at Carla, and his expression darkened to an angry glare before he stomped off himself.
"That could have gone better," Carla thought, staring at the blank paper before her.
She rubbed at her eyes, feeling tears forming.
"Allie loved Tesca. She truly loved him. I didn't know that."
A bitter laugh escaped her chest.
"No, that's a lie. I did know. I wouldn't have told her about his death like that if I didn't. I wanted to hurt her. I wanted revenge for her putting the bounty on my head."
She gave a loud, weary sigh.
"And I was wrong. It wasn't her. I could see it in her eyes. In that moment, she wasn't capable of lying."
She buried her face in her hands, silent as tears fell from her eyes.
"Oh, Tesca," she moaned, "I can't do this alone."
For several minutes, she sat there, sobs racking her slender frame. Then she sat up again and looked at the slip of paper before her.
"But," she sighed, her voice heavy, "I will do my best."
And taking up the pen once more, she began to write. This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. If you'd like to learn more about the Freeze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.